Welcome, friends. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today. We are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia, but you can, of course, reach us worldwide wherever internet is available through our website, redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. Take a look at our Twitter feed, YouTube channels, and RSS and podcast feeds. It's all available on the website, so you can follow us at your convenience. And I hope you're comfortable wherever you are, in front of the computer, on your couch, relaxing in the bed, or maybe taking a walk with your headphones on, as we are going to spend some time today with author and freelance journalist Philip Willan. He has been specializing in Italian parapolitics, and he has worked in Rome for more than 20 years, and he's the author of Puppet Masters, The Political Use of Terrorism in Italy, and his latest book is called The Last Supper, The Mafia, The Masons, and The Killing of Roberto Calvi. And I was highlighted to Philip's work in a recent article that came up on in the British newspaper The Guardian, the online version. Got me kind of curious in his work, so we've invited him today to talk about his work, the Mafia, the Masons, the Vatican, the P2 Lodge, the killing of Roberto Calvi, and the relationship between Banco Ambrosiano and the Vatican Bank. So with that, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Philip. Thank you very much for coming on the program.
It's a pleasure.
It's really, really good to have you here. We really appreciate some of your time here today. I think this is a really interesting topic that I've been following for a long time, and I'd love to get your take on it all, so to speak. And maybe you can just tell us a little bit how you kind of first got on this trail. You've been spending a lot of time in Italy, of course, but were you alerted to this issue as soon as Roberto Calvi was murdered, or have you been having an interest in Vatican business, so to speak, even before this, Philip?
Well, my introduction to these topics really came many years ago when I was asked to collaborate on the research for a book that was written by David Yalop called In God's Name, which is about the alleged murder of Pope John Paul I. And that was really my first introduction to the Vatican Bank scandal, the Banco Ambrosiano, the P2 Masonic Lodge, and all the mysterious elements that revolve around this story. I was living and working as a journalist in Italy when Roberto Calvi died, and I was very interested in the subject really from the moment that that happened. And then I had the opportunity to look at things in greater detail when I was working on the research for David Yalop's book, and I did further research for another British journalist called Charles Raw, who wrote a book called The Money Changers, which is specifically about the Vatican Bank and its relationship with Calvi and the Banco Ambrosiano. So before I did my own book, I'd done quite a bit of work for other colleagues who'd been looking into these matters.
Interesting. And how about like the P2 Lodge and Masonic research overall? Was that a subject that you were familiar with, or did this simply came up along your research?
Well, those were really an integral part of the context of Roberto Calvi's life and death. So really from the very beginning, when he first disappeared was missing for a couple of weeks and then eventually turned up dead in London. The fact that he was a member of P2 and that he'd had business dealings with Licio Gelli, the head of the lodge, and with Umberto Ortolani, who was the financial brains of the organization. All this was part of the story from the very beginning, from the moment that he disappeared and then was found dead under Blackfriars Bridge in London.
And that is something we definitely are going to go into a little bit more in detail here later on. But maybe you can just mention a little bit of more of the background story in regards to Roberto Calvi and what he was doing and what kind of job he had in regards to Banco Ambrosiano, the Vatican bank, right?
Well, the Banco Ambrosiano was the biggest independent Catholic bank in Italy. It was very much under the influence of the Catholic Church, having originally been founded by a clergyman, and was very much under the influence of the Diocese of Milan, where the bank was headquartered. As far as we know, it wasn't actually officially and or anyway overtly owned by the Vatican, but there were very close business dealings between Calvi and Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, who was the American-Lithuanian head of the Vatican Bank at the time. So they were very closely linked, and some people suggest that perhaps the Vatican Bank, which is known by the initials IOR, was the real owner and controller of the Banco Ambrosiano, but that's a controversial matter, and it's not certainly not a matter of public record.
So what happened here in regards to Roberto Calvi then, if we go into some detail about his murder, and maybe you can begin to paint the picture for us, so to speak, about what you think actually happened, and we can kind of slowly go into the different theories, I guess, as well, and you can mention from what angle you can come to this. There's a lot of different threads here. We have the Masons being kind of accused on one hand. We have the Vatican themselves that might possibly have done it and are maybe looking to accuse the Masons of doing it, considering the way that Roberto Calvi was murdered. But tell us a little bit about what you think about this, Philip.
Yes, well, Calvi disappeared in the summer of 1982. His bank was in deep financial trouble. And in fact, he had a part of his problem was that he had a $300 million loan, which he was expected to repay to the Vatican Bank. In fact, he had a deadline of the end of June for doing that. And at a certain point, he disappeared from Milan, where his bank was headquartered, and he traveled down to Rome. And he then just sort of disappeared off the map for a while. And in fact, he put himself in the hands of some very dubious characters, a man called Flavio Carboni, who was a kind of wheeler-dealer in Rome with political contacts and strong contacts with the secret services. Carboni helped to organize Calvi's disappearance, effectively. They traveled up to Trieste in the northeast, and there Calvi escaped by boat, a boat that was provided to him by a man called Silvano Vitor, who was a friend of Carboni's. In fact, they were both dating two sisters. So clearly there was a close relationship there. Vitor was basically a smuggler. He would travel back and forth across the Adriatic, smuggling things like jeans and cigarettes and any sort of product that was in short supply in Yugoslavia from Italy. So he obviously had a lot of criminal contacts, and he was, in fact, also an informant of the finance police. So Vitor took Calvi away in his boat, and they went to Yugoslavia, and then they traveled across country to Klagenfurt in Austria, which was the home of the Kleinzig sisters, who were these two sisters who were having an affair with both Carboni and Vitor. So they stayed there at the Kleinzig family home. And then they organized a private flight to London. Basically, it's believed that Calvi wanted to go to London. Initially, he was planning to go to Switzerland, but he was persuaded to change his mind and choose London instead. And it's believed that he was looking for a discreet location where he could organize negotiations with contacts in the business world to try and save his bank from bankruptcy. It's very likely that he was trying to pressure people that he had done business with in the past to help him out of this tight spot that he found himself in. Yes. And almost certainly he would, where possible, use blackmail to convince people that they must help him, otherwise he would reveal damaging things about what they had done together, or also they would be caught up in the collapse of his bank and would suffer damage in that way as well. And probably one of the institutions that he was trying to put pressure on was the Vatican Bank itself. And in fact, in his suitcase, which it appears he left at Klagenfurt with the Kleinsieg family, although that in itself is still somewhat mysterious, what exactly happened to his briefcase containing a lot of sensitive documents and the kind of documents that he could use to blackmail people. In this briefcase, among the documents that have come to light, there were letters to important figures in the Vatican, even a letter to Pope John Paul II, mm-hmm. In which he reminds these people of what he had done to help the Vatican in the context of the Cold War, helping them in connection with the Solidarity Trade Union in Poland, and also in the ideological conflict that was taking place in Latin America, where the Banco Ambrosiano had a strong presence, and also where Lee Chogeli and P2 were very active and present. So it seems clear that he was trying to pressure people into giving him financial support at that stage. Almost certainly he was trying to pressure Gelli himself and Ortolani, who had received very large sums of money from the Banco Ambrosiano. Mm. The question, though, is what was in the bag that has never come to light? Because a judicial investigation has established that Carboni sold a part of the contents of the bag to a Czechoslovak bishop called Monsignor Pavel Nilitsa. Mm-hmm. And it's very likely that if there were documents that might have been extremely damaging and embarrassing for the Vatican, those documents were bought by Monsignor Nilitsa and have never come to light. So we can really only speculate on what they might have contained. But it does seem likely that given the documents that have come to light and the tenor of them and the menacing tone of them, that there may have been other things even more sensitive, but probably relating to similar activities, Cold War activities, the battle against communism around the world, which obviously the Catholic Church had a strong interest in because it was suffering persecution in Eastern Europe, and atheist communism was a natural enemy.
Do you know what kind of battle, I should say, then the Vatican was involved in? Has that come to light in any way, what they actually did to actively fight communism in these countries?
Yes, I think there's no doubt that at least a part of the Catholic Church was strongly aligned with the right-wing dictatorships in Latin America, people like Pinochet or the military junta in Argentina. And it's very likely that conservative elements in the Vatican and in the Catholic Church worldwide felt strongly allied with these right-wing leaders and provided them with moral support in their ideological battle against communism. And from Calvi's letters that came to light subsequently, it would appear that they possibly also provided financial support and maybe even money that could have been used to arm some of these right-wing dictatorships. But probably the most significant contribution of the Vatican to the Cold War was their role in Poland, because the Pope himself was Polish and was hugely admired and popular in his homeland. And he came out very strongly in support of Solidarity. He received Solidarity leaders in the Vatican, and he made a very high-profile visit, pilgrimage to Poland shortly after becoming Pope. So it was clear that Solidarity enjoyed his overt moral support, but it's also suggested that money was channeled to the organization to help it to campaign against the communist regime in Poland. And almost certainly the Vatican Bank would have been involved in that. And it's alleged that the Banco Ambrosiano was involved as well. There have been claims that, for example, a large sum of money, some millions of dollars, were secretly transported to Poland in the form of gold ingots. And Francesco Pazienza, who is another of these mysterious figures, rather similar to Carboni, someone who had strong contacts in the business world, who worked with Calvi and advised him, but who also had very strong contacts with the Italian secret services and possibly also with the American CIA. He has given evidence in court saying that he was personally involved in this operation to smuggle the gold ingots into Poland. And he described how it was done, what kind of car they used. And he claimed that the money came originated with the Vatican Bank. So clearly there was a lot of cloak and dagger activity going on, possibly somewhat removed from the core business of the Catholic Church, one might say, but perhaps understandable given that they had the international reach. They had a financial institution such as the IOR, which enabled them to move money discreetly around the world in a way that many other similar institutions would have found difficult. And they had an ideological reason for wanting to combat communism because they were being persecuted and suffering. Their followers in Eastern Europe were suffering under communist regimes. So what happened, I think, is it's plausible that kind of thing could have happened. And it's also understandable that people in the Vatican, in the Catholic Church, might have felt that they were justified in that kind of conduct at that time.
But it's definitely, you know, really troubling to hear that at the same time, because under these, you know, dictatorships, a lot of people obviously have been murdered. And what I'm reminded of as well is this what is known as the rat lines, pretty much, which was, I don't know if you've researched this or if you want to go into it, but this idea that the Vatican, in many cases, helped to get Nazis out of Europe after the Second World War, primarily into South America. And some of these were like Adolf Eichmann, Klaus Barbie, Joseph Mengele, and many others. Have you looked into that at all?
Yes, it's a subject I'm familiar with. There are allegations that Lee Giorgelli himself played a role in that. And certainly there are allegations that the Vatican played a role as well. And there are a number of senior church figures, I think particularly very conservative figures from Croatia, for example, who helped Nazi war criminals to escape to South America at the end of the war. Again, I think it's perhaps a result of the Catholic Church's view that it sort of extends to all sides of all conflicts and has a kind of human understanding for all sides, and equally possibly felt that some of these extremely right-wing Nazi figures were potentially assets in the coming Cold War, a very similar view to that was taken by the CIA and British intelligence as well, probably.
Yes, exactly. I'm reminded as well, I think CIA run their own program, I think together with the British, called Operation Paperclip, which much in the same way took people like Wernher von Braun, for instance, out of Nazi Germany into America, where he could continue his rocket science. And this eventually even led to the Apollo program and the success of that mission. So that's interesting.
Yes, that's right. I think there was a feeling that people who particularly had access to useful intelligence on the Soviet Union or Eastern Europe and who were anti-communist were potentially useful allies. All that could be done was done to smuggle them out and recruit them for the new global conflict that was brewing at that time in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War.
Yes. I want to ask you a little bit about who you think kind of took care of him, Roberto Calvi, that is, when he came up to England. Do you know if England in any way was involved in or governmental figures, political leaders or whatnot, made sure that he was safe once he got there? Or who do you think took care of him there?
Well, it's not at all clear who he met while he was in England. One or two people have come forward to claim that they had contact with him in London. Unfortunately, the story is very difficult to piece together because almost all the witnesses tend to be very bizarre and very unreliable. And unfortunately, we have their word and very little else that is sort of unquestionable fact to help to piece together the mosaic. For example, one of the few people who has claimed that he met Calvi in London and went to the residence where he was staying is a man called Berti, who was a Venezuelan businessman who had been involved in rather dubious financial activities on behalf of the Catholic Church in Venezuela. And he, in fact, he had been involved in a dispute with the Venezuelan church. So he was the kind of person that Calvi might have been interested in talking to if he was looking for damaging material to use against the Vatican, if he was trying to put them under pressure and blackmail them. This man has since died, Jaime Berti, his name was. Mm-hmm. And I met him, though, some years ago because he came back to Rome to give evidence about his contacts with Calvi. And he ended up being arrested by the magistrates in Rome and kept in prison for a number of weeks, the kind of treatment that would probably discourage other people from coming forward. Mm. Again, he was a very strange, unreliable kind of figure who'd been involved in probably illegal or dishonest activities and made some very wild claims about a kind of global conspiracy involving the mafia and the Catholic Church and other forces. Unfortunately, though, he was never able to back up his claims with solid proof. So his story remains fairly unclear as to how much of it is true and how much of it was invention. And equally, we don't know for sure whether his claim to have met Calvi is true or not. I think it's quite likely and plausible that Calvi would have been interested in meeting a man like him. It probably is quite likely that he called on Calvi in his residence. But again, he's the kind of man that you couldn't say, you know, if this is what he is claiming, then we should take his word for it, because clearly his word was unreliable.
You met with him, though. Did you feel he was sincere, or did you feel that there was some kind of he might have been hiding something, or what was your impression of him?
Well, he was a very pleasant, charming, sort of sophisticated businessman. It was difficult to make out how sincere he might have been. On the face of it, he was a pleasant and likable person to talk to. The trouble is that when people become involved in these very sensitive activities, the the truth is one of the most expendable of the commodities that they trade in. And very often, if they've done very sensitive or illegal things, they're really not at liberty to tell you the full truth in any case. So he was one of the many people who gave the impression of being somewhat indecipherable. But I think probably on balance, I would say that much of his story probably pans out that he definitely had these business dealings on behalf of the church in Venezuela, and he got into trouble because of them. So he definitely frequented the kind of world of dodgy business activities linked to the Vatican and the Catholic Church that he claimed to have frequented, and which was exactly the kind of world that Calvi himself was moving in.
Mm. What do you make of some of the allegations about the ties to the mafia, the involvement even between the mafia and the Vatican, for instance? Is that anything you entertain or bring up in your writings?
Yes, I mean, that's very much a theme of the book. It was very much a theme of the murder trial that was celebrated in Rome a couple of years ago, and which I followed very closely because it coincided with the period I was working on the research for my book and then actually writing the book. The trial itself was an interesting opportunity because as a result of it, the 20 years or more of official investigation documents became public because the prosecutor presented an enormous quantity of documents as evidence to the court to back up his thesis that five people had been responsible for taking Calvi to London and organizing his murder. So that was a great opportunity. These documents, many of them had been leaked in the past, but basically the full Calvi murder investigation entered the public domain. So that was a very useful thing for me. And then the actual trial being celebrated in Rome was an opportunity because all sorts of witnesses from around the world were called to give evidence. Mm. And so many of them came to Rome and gave evidence in court, and one had the opportunity to buttonhole them when they'd finished speaking to the court and see if they were prepared to talk privately to a journalist. And in many cases, people were prepared to talk to me, and it made it, it was a big advantage for me in getting hold of these witnesses. But on the negative side, though, the trial itself didn't really clarify exactly what happened in a really satisfactory way. Perhaps too long a time had passed since the event in question. So many of the witnesses appeared in court and said they couldn't remember things. Mm. And you couldn't say whether that was a natural phenomenon because a long time had passed. Many of them were elderly and some of them in poor health. So you couldn't expect them to remember things from 25 years earlier. But equally, a lot of the witnesses were very reluctant to remember things. And so they could simply say that they couldn't remember and there wasn't anything that could be done about it. You couldn't torture them and you couldn't even plausibly say that, that they were lying because such a long time had passed. But it was frustrating because clearly people who had sensitive knowledge about what happened at that time for understandable reasons didn't want to talk publicly about their knowledge in the court. And so at the end of the day, the trial went on for, I think it was about 18 months.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, it didn't really clarify things as much as one might have hoped. And in fact, as a result, the judges concluded that the evidence was insufficient to convict any of the five suspects. So that they were all acquitted. Some, because the judges said that there was no evidence whatever that they had been involved in the crime, and others, they said the evidence was simply insufficient. The prosecutor has appealed against some of those acquittals, and it's expected that in the next few months, sometime in the autumn, there could be an appeal hearing in Rome to finally lay the whole matter to rest. But definitely the trial was a serious setback for the prosecutor, because he did a lot of work putting together this case against the suspects. What one of the main defendants was a mafia boss called Pippo Calò, who was very influential at the time of Roberto Calvi's life and death. Basically, he represented the mafia, the Sicilian mafia, in Rome, and had contacts almost certainly with Italian politicians and representatives of the secret services. And he was often described as the mafia's cashier, who basically handled money for them, and would have handled money that it is alleged was laundered for Cosa Nostra by the Banco Ambrosiano and by the Vatican Bank itself. That was definitely one of the strands of the trial. Numerous mafia turncoats who've given evidence in return for lower sentences have made that claim. Unfortunately, the claim hasn't been really incontestably proven in terms of actual money flows and bank accounts, possibly because the money was handled in a very discreet way and moved around in cash, was deliberately more or less untraceable. So there is this theory that the Banco Ambrosiano and the Vatican Bank were laundering money on behalf of the mafia. When Calvi got into financial difficulty and wasn't able to pay back the money that he owed, then Cosa Nostra stepped in and was instrumental in Calvi's execution under Blackfriars Bridge in London. That was a part of the prosecution case. Unfortunately, the judges said it wasn't sufficiently proven.
So a number of questions I want to ask in relationship to what you just talked about here, but in regards to the five suspects, were they all involved in the mafia? Were they related to the Vatican or some other group?
Well, they were, they represented different interests. One of them was Flavio Carboni's Austrian girlfriend, Manuela Kleinzig. And effectively, she came to London with Carboni, and she assisted him and made her own bank accounts available for his use. But she was very young, I don't know, around 19 or 20 at the time, and it seems very unlikely that she played any significant
role.
Sort of aware role in a plot to murder Calvi.
Yes.
She was accused of being involved in the murder, but she was acquitted, and the judges said that there was absolutely no convincing evidence implicating her in the murder. Then there was Flavio Carboni himself, and he certainly didn't come out of the trial very well. He traveled with Calvi to London, and in fact, he organized the trip to London, and then Calvi was very unhappy with the accommodation that had been provided for him in London. And Carboni came then to try and find somewhere more comfortable and more appropriate for the head of a major Italian bank. But he spent a lot of his time in London avoiding personal contact with Calvi, and possibly was aware that something nasty was going to happen to Calvi, and so took care not to be on the spot when that happened. There was some very powerful evidence that was given against him in the trial by a mafia boss who had been collaborating with the Italian authorities, called Giuffre. And he talked about the Calvi murder as a classic mafia-style murder, where the person who is due to be murdered is cultivated by somebody that the mafia sends to become friends with him and gain his confidence. And this person then wins the confidence of the victim and delivers the victim to his executioners. And Giuffre said this was a classic modus operandi of the Vatican, and that in this case, that had been the role of Flavio Carboni. And because Giuffre was such an influential figure in Cosa Nostra, he'd been at a very high level up until his arrest, only a matter of a couple of years earlier, he spoke with great personal knowledge, and his evidence against Carboni was very chilling, really, to listen to the description in court and to see how his description of the classic mafia murder coincided with the conduct of Carboni. But again, Carboni was, together with all the other defendants, acquitted for lack of evidence. Then there was another figure who was a major player in the Rome underworld, in an organization called the Banda della Magliana, which operated in Rome, had contacts with Cosa Nostra, close contacts with Pippo Calò, for example, and also had contacts with Italian politicians and the police and secret services at the time. And this man's name was Ernesto Diotalevi, and he had been in contact with Carboni and had helped to organize the false passport that Calvi used to flee Italy and to find his way to London. So he'd been present in the kind of logistics of Calvi's trip. And he was certainly an unsavory character who had these strong criminal links and had been prosecuted for a number of crimes, although I think he almost always has been acquitted. And again, in this case, he was acquitted as well. His defense lawyer was actually very effective, because every witness who gave evidence in the course of the trial would be questioned by the lawyer acting on behalf of Diotalevi, and he would ask them, do you know my client? Do you know if my client had any role in the Calvi murder? And he would ask two or three questions that went right to the heart of the case against Diotalevi, and almost invariably the witnesses would say no. There was no one who appeared in court who was in a position to say that Diotalevi had played a role in the crime and had been involved in the murder. So on the basis of the evidence presented against him, it was fair enough that the court decided that he couldn't be convicted. And the other defendant, of course, was Silvano Vitor, who definitely accompanied Calvi on his trip to Yugoslavia and then to Austria, and who really went with him every step of the journey. Effectively, he provided the beginning, the logistics for leaving Italy, and then he continued in a kind of bodyguard role, accompanying Calvi to London and staying in the same residence, Chelsea Cloisters, a big residence in the centre of London. But just at the crucial moment when Calvi disappeared in London, Vitor also disappeared and effectively left him on his own, possibly, according to the prosecution, in a kind of coordinated move, leaving Calvi undefended for the people who picked him up and executed him. But again, after all these years, it was very difficult to prove that in court. And although Vitor provided very contradictory evidence himself about what had happened, to such an extent that the judge even pointed out to him at one point that under Italian law, a defendant has the right to lie in his own defense. That's not held against you under the Italian legal system, I think.
Really?
Perhaps realistically they consider that given that people accused of a serious crime are very likely to lie in their own defense, that there's no point in making a pretense that they're obliged to tell the truth, and they have a kind of civic duty that if they want to lie, they can lie to defend themselves. It's a kind of very sort of realpolitik view of things. But the judge said, you have this constitutional right to lie in your own defense. But if you don't tell us a coherent story that is not internally self-contradictory, clearly we're not going to be able to believe you, because he was all over the place in his evidence. So the judge actually intervened to sort of give him a kind of word of friendly advice that if he wanted to be taken seriously, he needed to present a much more coherent story. He wasn't really up to it. But again, the fact that he contradicted himself, almost certainly told a lot of lies, the court didn't feel that was sufficient reason for judging him to be guilty of murder. So he too was acquitted for lack of evidence. And of course, the other defendant was Pippo Calò, who was a very interesting figure. He participated in the trial, apart from one occasion when he actually came physically to Rome to give evidence. On the whole, he participated in the trial by video link from Ascoli Piceno prison, where he is serving a life sentence for other crimes. And he was very sort of old style mafia boss, extremely polite and courteous towards the judges and all the members of the court. Very apparently old-fashioned in his views. For example, he was very critical of some of the mafia witnesses who had given evidence against him, saying that their accounts couldn't be taken seriously because they were unreliable unreliable individuals who had contacts with the police or the secret services, or who were personally immoral, had mistresses. In particular, Tommaso Buscetta, who's a very famous pentito from Cosa Nostra, and who knew Pippo Calò and gave evidence against him, and who came up and visited Calò in London. Calò said that he was a man whose word was worth nothing because he was so immoral that he had a mistress and betrayed his wife, and he even had the the Gaul to come to land to Rome with his mistress and appear at Calo's home accompanied by his mistress, sort of bringing dishonor on everyone. Mm. And it appeared that in Calo's moral code, betraying your wife with the mistress was far more serious than committing murder. He himself had almost certainly been responsible for dozens of murders, which he presumably had no difficulty in justifying to his own conscience. But betraying your wife and taking a mistress was absolutely beyond the pale, at least in the show that he put on for the court.
How about that? That's very, very interesting hearing about this stuff. And I did have no idea that this was a part of Italian law, so to speak, that you could lie. But I want to ask you here a little bit. Maybe we can spend a few minutes on this before we round things up here for our first hour. And that is the different theories then, of course, surrounding Calvi's death and what you think happened here. One theory is that he took his life, of course. Another is that he was strangled actually at another location and then kind of planted under the Blackfriars Bridge with a noose around his neck, bricks in his pocket. And some say that even Freemasons actually were behind this murder because of the symbolic way he was killed and the way he hanged with the noose and all that. What do you think of these theories and what's your point of view here? What do you hold? Is there one you favor above another?
Yes, one of the few things that came out of the long trial in Rome was that the court said unequivocally that Calvi had been murdered after considering all the evidence that was put to it, including a lot of forensic evidence. They said that although the case against the defendants was insufficiently proven, they had no doubt that Calvi had been killed. So that was a useful step forward. A civil court, in fact, had come to a similar conclusion some years ago in Milan in a dispute over the personal life insurance that Calvi had taken out, and his insurer was ordered to pay compensation to his family.
Yes.
On the basis of that policy. Because the civil court was convinced that Calvi had been murdered. If he had taken his own life, the policy would not have been valid, and therefore the insurer would not have had to pay out any money. But the fact that this was a criminal court that was considering specifically the allegation that Calvi had been murdered, and specifically that these five people who were on trial were responsible for it, that I think carries even greater weight. I personally have always believed that Calvi, at least the balance of probabilities, was that Calvi had been murdered. For one thing, I always felt that the bricks that were weighing down his body, it suggested that they may have had a symbolic Masonic significance, or alternatively, simply that he had loaded his clothes with bricks because initially he had intended to drown himself in the river. But one of the things that I always found that, to my mind at least, militated against the suicide theory was that one of the bricks was placed down the front of his trousers in front of the fly. Mm-hmm. So basically was sort of sitting on his genitals. And it just seemed to me that that's not the kind of thing that you would do to yourself.
Right.
Even if you're desperate and you're about to kill yourself, it seems to be such a lack of respect for your own body and so uncomfortable and unnatural that I always found that that seemed to be a very powerful piece of evidence that the brick was put there by other people. And in fact, yes. in the discussions in the trial, that there was a discussion of the fact that one of the fly buttons from his fly was missing, another had been broken, and it appeared that possibly the brick had been rammed in through the front of his flies rather violently, again in a way that wouldn't happen if somebody was doing this to themselves, simply weighing down their body with bricks. They wouldn't have to place the brick in through the front in the course doing so, damaging the fly buttons. My view is that almost certainly Calvi was killed. Certainly, if he committed suicide, it was a very strange suicide. And if he was murdered, it was also a very strange murder, very complicated, taking him to this particular location, which, of course, again, people see as being a reference to Freemasonry or to the Catholic Church, the name of the bridge being Blackfriars Bridge, then the presence of the bricks in his pockets, another reference to Freemasonry, according to some people. Clearly, stringing him up in that way under the bridge in the middle of the night, if it was a murder, if that is how the crime took place, which now appears to be certainly the view of the Italian investigators, exposed the people responsible for the murder to considerable, perhaps unnecessary, risk of discovery. So it would seem that perhaps if these symbolic aspects of the staging of his death have a genuine value, they were so important that people would run the risk of discovery to carry out this complex maneuver of taking the body on a boat and stringing him up from the scaffolding that happened to be under the bridge at that time, because repairs were taking place to the banks of the River Thames at that point. And if the scaffolding had not been there, it would have been almost impossible for the death to be staged in that particular way. But if it was a murder, it was complex and difficult and risky. And yet that, according to the investigators, is the way things happened. Mm-hmm. And I think possibly I accept that that is the most likely view of what happened as well.
Okay, really, really interesting. I definitely want to continue talking more about this here then in our next segment, and go into a little bit more other things as well in regards to P2. Maybe we can talk a little bit more about Licio Gelli, the Mafia. I want to ask you a little bit more about the Vatican in general, Vatican II and so forth. But to run things up here for the first hour, I want to mention the website, Philip's website. Simply go to philipwillan.com. That's the last name is spelled WILLAN.com. We will have this linked up from our end, of course. You can click through easily. The book is called The Last Supper, The Mafia, The Masons, and The Killing of Roberto Calvi. Philip, can people order your book through the website?
They certainly can. They can click on the website, and that will take them through to Amazon, where they can order online.
Join us in our member section as we continue our fascinating conversation with Philip Villan. You do not want to miss this program as we discuss more on Propaganda Due, the P2 Lodge, and their Grand Master Licio Gelli. We talk about Freemasons and the possible P2 membership of people within the Vatican. We also discuss the murder of Pope John Paul I after only 33 days in office. What's the message there? We talk about the Swiss connection, not only to Hans Kunz, but the Pontifical Swiss Guard of Vatican City as well. Are there any connections to the powerful financial forces of Switzerland and the fact that they hold the World Economic Forum in Davos every year? We also discussed the card found on Roberto Calvi from the law firm Slaughter and May, and we round things up talking about Operation Gladio and Opus Dei. Go to our website, redhatscreations.com, click on members if you're already a member, or on subscribe to join us for our Hour 2 with Philip Villan. We have a year of free radio available for you up on our website, and when you want to have more, consider signing up for a membership. We have the documentary film Architects of Control featured up there right now. You'll get instant access to our radio archives going back to 2006 with the extended second hour interviews. We have video interviews, webcasts, and much more up there for you as well. It's only 16 euro cents per day. Try us out for 3 months and you'll support an independent, truth-seeking radio program that is brought to you without commercial interruption. So join us now for hour two of this program after some music. Thank you.